Good morning. So last time we sort of used this carrier sense idea. So this was going to be, you know, our primary way of mostly avoiding collisions. And, you know, under kind of a very naive model, it works pretty well because, well, the only way we collide is if we decide to transmit at exactly the same time. And so we can do this thing where, you know, we, you know, try to transmit some, you know, fixed number of slots after the last transmission, or some using some central timestamp. And as long as we don't choose the same slot, we can avoid having a conflict, and we can sort of design things so we don't choose the same slot most of the time. But there's some complications with this, which we'll go back to in a bit, about, well, you know, there's actually propagation delay. We can't actually instantaneously detect that. You mentioned to talk about collision detection, where I'm sorry, I badly fumbled an example because I decided not to work it out in advance and then messed up the speed of light and said, oh, well, I know what the result's supposed to be, so let's work backwards and see why that's happening. So I'll briefly go through that today. But collision detection is an idea we can use in some types of multi-access networks. Probably the most well-known example is classic Ethernet. And the idea here is that we have collision, but recover sort of fast from it. That we quickly abandon the transmission when there's a collision. So in the case of kind of classic Ethernet, we spend the time for transmitting about 64 bytes on a collision rather than spending out a whole 1500 byte packet. Or worse, if we wanted to use larger frame sizes, which, you know, would improve performance, so people do like to turn that on, though if you're doing that, you probably have switched Ethernet these days. And collision detection has this problem that we need to kind of detect our collision reliably at the transmitters. The transmitters need to know there's a collision, so they both stop transmitting and know to retransmit the thing they just tried to send. And kind of our worst case for that is that we have our two transmitters are as far apart as we let nodes be, so they're going to see kind of the least overlap versus anyone in the network between their two packets. And I'm kind of showing this as a line, but something which happens in our real Ethernet networks is, remember, we can have like a hub. So we might have nodes at kind of varying distances in practice, but we're going to constrain it with this maximum distance, which is sometimes called the diameter of the network. Diameter because of this kind of network diagram, though it doesn't have to look like that. And the basic, the worst case is that we transmit a packet just before one gets to us that was furthest away as possible, and we need to make sure the other end knows that there's a collision too. And the way Ethernet handles that is they just constrain the maximum distance, and even when you have a collision, you always transmit for this minimum time. You never sort of don't do that. And the minimum time is the time for 64 bytes. So on 100 megabit Ethernet, which is the last version that used this type of collision detection, gigabit Ethernet doesn't do that. They require switching. This is about uh, 2.5 microseconds, and that gives us about a 512 meter cable, or like set of cables between A and B. Now, if you look at the actual IEEE standard, they specify the sort of maximum cable size is smaller than that. So for fiber, they specify it's smaller than that because, well, this is assuming that we kind of instantaneously read the signal, but they assume that that's going to take some time for the hardware to do that. And if we're talking about copper, the way Ethernet copper cables work is that there are electrical issues where the signal will propagate. On fiber, they actually say 412 nanometers. That's just trying to work. So that's my correction to that idea. So the key idea is that we want to make sure for collision detection, not only do we need to have the capability to hear the other signal while we're transmitting, which we mentioned on wireless, doesn't work because of the huge power difference. We also need to make sure that it actually overlaps for us, even if we're as far away as we allow our two transmitters to be. So then we talked about sort of problems in wireless. And one of our problems was that we can't do collision detection because of that trapped power issue. But we also had this other problem where we had these hidden and exposed nodes, that because it's not like a wire where we can basically say everyone on the wire gets all the same stuff, you know, maybe just with some delays, we can have cases where one node can hear different sets of other nodes. And this gave us kind of two problems that were going to be annoying for our efficiency. So one was the kind of hidden node problem where we have A and B, say, transmitting to C, but A and B can't transmit to each other because they're too far apart. So they're said to be hidden nodes from each other. And we also have this kind of complementary problem where we have two transmissions that should be independent, but kind of erroneously, our two transmitters hear each other, so carrier sense is going to tell them that they shouldn't transmit. So these are both cases where carrier sense works less well for wireless, because in the hidden node case, our carrier sense doesn't tell us about the actual interference at all. We'll just transmit anyways. And in the case of the exposed nodes, our carrier sense is going to tell us there's interference when there really isn't. And for the hidden node problem, one solution we had was this request to send, clear to send idea. And kind of the key thing, way that this worked, is that we'd send short requests, and these would sort of create reservations, reserved time for on the channel. Since they were short requests, yes, they could still collide, but they're a lot less likely to collide because they're shorter, you know, and there's just less chance for overlap. We need a smaller, quiet period to avoid collision. And these create reserve time on channel because these requests are going to say, hey, not only do I want to transmit, but I'm going to want to transmit this many bytes. And so on a request to send, a node will say, okay, you want to transmit that many bytes. I'm going to assume I might not be hearing back the clear to send message because maybe, you know, you're A making the request and, or C is making the request, and maybe I'm not hearing B, who is actually going to transmit. And if I transmit, I might be interfering. So I'll reserve the channel for long enough, assuming that transmission actually happens, unless I have reason to believe otherwise. And on the clear to send, we do the same thing. We say, someone is transmitting to this node I just heard. I need to assume that I'm likely to interfere if I transmit to. So I guess the clear to send is the more obvious one. So in the case of A and B transmitting, this would prevent that because we have our clear to send message being sent from B, and that would basically choose which of A and B get the channel, and the other one would say, look at the message and say, well, that's not for me. I can't transmit at all because I'm going to mess up C if I do that. In the case of request to send, this like maybe kind of exacerbates our exposed node problem. But you know, usually our assumption would be that, you know, even if usually our assumption would be that we're more likely to cause interference than be able to take advantage of exposed nodes. But maybe that's not always accurate. That depends on our like actual setup. And something that we kind of skipped over that complicates this is that we've kind of been assuming that like our reception of messages is always kind of symmetric, and that's not really true in practice, that it's possible for you to have a better receiver than the other end, so like you can hear things they send and not vice versa. So you know, it's not just the case that you know, we can know we have an exposed node or hidden node problem kind of directly. Okay, so questions about these things we covered last time? And my brief correction on our collision detection in Ethernet scenario. And the other thing with propagation delay I'd like to say over is like that it also kind of affects what we can do in wireless. So in 802.11b, which is like one of the very old version of wireless, they have this 50 milliseconds between frames and 50 microseconds and 10 microseconds slots. Remember, we were using the slots to determine when to retransmit, to choose our transmission time slot, and we do a carrier sense before then to make sure that the channel is free. If it isn't free, we don't bother retransmitting in that slot we chose. We wait to try again later after the next transmission and the next sort of minimum spacing period. And that 50 microseconds minimum spacing says, okay, that's the longest that we're allowed to actually sort of have to send back an ACK. Because if we send back an ACK after that, well, there's two issues. So one is that there's going to be a timeout for X, and the default timeout is less than that. The second problem is that, well, even if an ACK is sent back, it's likely to be clobbered by someone else transmitting on the channel. And so we can look at this number and figure out, okay, how far does 802.11b actually let us space transmitters, given that we want to do an acknowledgement to like, this is because this is how we detect collisions in sort of classic Wi-Fi. And we know that if we don't detect collisions, if we think of what TCP is going to do, it's going to behave horribly. Because it's going to say, oh, there's all this congestion. I should deal with all this congestion by not transmitting very much. Okay, so for figuring this out, using my correct calculations, 1 millisecond is about 300 meters at the speed of light. A microsecond, sorry. Of light. And to a first approximation, we'll say radio signals propagate at that speed and error, even though that's not going to be quite true. As we'll see when we talk about multipath, there's one reason why, you know, that might not be quite true, is that they don't go straight and all that stuff. But that's a pretty good approximation. So this 50 microseconds time for an ACK is going to be 15,000 meters. And what we actually need that to be is that if we're transmitting from A to B, we need that to be, that's going to be the gap the maximum gap because we have to get the ACK back before then. So kind of this says that, you know, we need, that this kind of says that we can't run this type of Wi-Fi as is over more than 7.5 kilometers. That it just won't work. But we actually kind of have a more constraining limit because these slot sizes mean, well, what's going to happen when we have our last transmission? When we don't have contention, we know what happens is that we're going to transmit, you know, after the 50 microsecond period for ACKs and no one else. But when we do have contention, we know the strategy is that we choose one of these slots that are 10 microseconds. And the idea is that if we choose two different slots, the only way that we will never interfere with each other because of carrier sets. But the problem is that if we're too far apart, our propagation delay can mess up that carrier sense. And so this would be a scenario where, like, A finishes transmitting to B, and then we have C and D that are far apart, both waiting for their turn to transmit. They're going to interfere. And our hope is that they'll sense each other and realize not to do that, but to do that, we need to have them be less than 10 microsecond signal time apart from each other. If they aren't, then they're not, even though we don't have a hidden node problem, they're still gonna, the carrier sense isn't gonna actually work. And this gives us a distance of, you know, since it's 10 microseconds, it's gonna be about 3 kilometers distance from each other. Questions, reasoning here? So if you followed things about Wi-Fi, you might know that some people run Wi-Fi over distances that are much longer than these numbers. Like the record for like longest Wi-Fi link is like 180 kilometers or something like that. So when they do that, well, there's a couple things that are going on. So one thing that's going on is that they typically use parabolic transmitters that can deliberately reflect the signal from a wide range and direct the signal in one direction, rather than our typical omnidirectional thing that like a laptop antenna will do, because we don't know what your relative orientation of the laptop and your hotspot is. The other thing that they'll do is that they will typically have to make protocol tweaks, like increasing ACK timeouts or just turning off ACKs to make that work. And typically, these are point-to-point. And that's very helpful because that means you don't have to worry about collisions. Right? If you're going between, if there's only two nodes, you can coordinate much more easily there. And the other thing you might say is, well, these distance limits are kind of disturbing if we think about how the cellular world works. So the cellular world uses a different strategy to avoid collisions, because if we did something Wi-Fi-like, we need to increase these times a lot to deal with the case where we like have one cell tower covering, you know, a 10-plus kilometer area, which is not uncommon in less populated areas. So one thing, mentioning signal propagation, I mentioned this idea we could direct our signals. And one thing that happens is that the environment kind of does that for us. That, for example, it might be the case that we have walls that are either that not just absorb signals, but reflect signals, or other things in the environment that it reflects signals. And this means that our signal will often have multiple ways to get to its destination. And usually these extra ways will be kind of interference. That doesn't have to be the case. So like if I have this situation, maybe this is the strongest way for the signal to get there is actually an indirect path. But usually the other paths will, the indirect, the longer paths will be sort of lower in power because they're being reflected off an imperfect reflector. We probably do not paint our walls with something that perfectly reflects Wi-Fi signals. And if we did that, we'd probably have problems with our Wi-Fi. And an issue here is that these reflected paths are a little bit longer than our non-reflected paths. And this means that this, even though the difference in propagation delay is going to be teeny, this is actually kind of a problem because of this kind of an issue with phase. That if we think of radio signals, they have kind of a base frequency where they have these peaks at that roughly that frequency. And when we offset it, if our slight offsetting of our new signal aligns, then we will kind of increase those peaks. We'll make those peaks stronger. We'll make the signal easier to receive. If they kind of don't align, if they're what's called out of phase, they'll make the signal harder to receive. So these multipath ideas mean that, you know, our notion of like sort of the actual strength of Wi-Fi signals in a real or other wireless signals in a real environment is not just a straightforward how far am I from the antenna thing. That we can have this kind of self-interference that depends on how the signals align. And in the case of the frequencies we use for Wi-Fis, the physical distance when these signals are being transmitted between the peaks is on the order of centimeters. So this means that relatively small variation can have a more significant variation in our sort of received power. And so here, like the idea here, this is that we have our original signal and our reflected one is very slightly offset. So depending on that alignment. And this is like assuming we have these like teeny difference in the paths. If we have a longer distance, we can have the symbols that are being transmitted. So we can think of, you know, as an approximation, we're gonna send, you know, 0 or 1 would be the simplest idea of symbols. On sort of modern Wi-Fi, they typically have a way of encoding like several bits of information sort of at once, and they separate the signal into these symbols that are decoded to get sort of a single number, and then we have the next symbol that gets us a single number, and so on. And these symbols take a certain amount of time, and if the symbols start overlapping when they're not supposed to because of this interference, if we're kind of copying one signal on top of another, then things can get really bad and they can get unintelligible. This is typically more of a very, when we have the big difference in the distance between the paths. And I guess if you've done like AM radio or shortwave, there's the, you know, version of this where you have an echoey signal for like an actual audio radio, but I assume most people don't do that type of thing. So around here. And so this multipath interference is one of the reasons why it's annoyingly hard to predict, you know, how far Wi-Fi is going to go or other things like that, where we're going to have good reception. And it also, because it depends on that phase alignment, it varies on frequency a lot. This means that one strategy, and a strategy that's used on cellular networks a lot, to avoid this is that you can have frequency diversity. Is that rather than just transmitting on one frequency, you can transmit you can choose on a bunch of frequencies because probably one of them is not going to have bad alignment. And it would seem like, you know, for a first approximation, this multipath idea is, you know, just not good. Like, it makes it harder for us to receive our signals. It's going to corrupt them in weird ways. It means that when we encode our symbols, we have to think about what's going to happen to this symbol that I, you know, I coded my symbols as a, you know, this nice peak, go down, this sort of thing. What's that going to actually look like after it gets destroyed by this? Which is not a CS problem so much, but the ECE people have lots of trouble with that. So it seems like this is all bad. But what's happened in sort of modern wireless techniques is that there's been deliberate ways of taking advantage of this, of multipath transmission. And a big way to do that is by deliberately having multiple antennas and receivers. And so it's very common in kind of modern Wi-Fi and modern cellular that we'll have our base stations and our often our user devices, our laptops, and cell phones, and so on, will have multiple antennas either sending and or receiving. And kind of the simplest way to use this is we can say, well, if the reception's going to be different for things that are very slightly spaced because of these, this type of interference, if we have two antennas, even if they're not very far apart, you know, it's worth trying both of them and seeing which one works best. So we can, for example, receive the signal two times, see which one's better. And because we know that sometimes these interference patterns like are very short, you know, if the two, even though the two antennas aren't hugely far apart, we might, that might help us a lot getting good signal. And if we have multiple sending antennas, we can send out a test pattern and have the device respond back to us and say which way is, you know, better, and choose how to send to each sort of node we're talking to based on that. And like we typically would have a different profile for each like cell phone or laptop we're talking to at the time. But we can do something which is more clever, and this is something that doesn't really solve the problem of when we're on the edge of the range, but when we have a good signal, we can take advantage of this multipath idea, and we can just say, well, you know, if we have these kind of independent signals, these signals that are going separately, we can send, deliberately send two signals through the same space and receive them, and we just need to figure out how they're mixed, and we can unmix them. So there's this idea called multiple input, multiple output, which combines multiple sending antennas and multiple receiving antennas, where we send what are called multiple spatial streams. So what we'll have there is we'll have, say, our transmitter A and our receiver B. Our transmitter A, rather than, you know, just choosing one of its antennas to send with, it will send with both of them, and it will send two different signals, two independent streams of data. But you might say, wait, there's a problem here, that B here, yes, it has two receivers, but we can't just magically only receive one of the signals with one of the receivers and one with the other. And because we have these multiple paths, these signals are going to be mixed. And like, really, we have some extra paths, right, that mix the signals. And if these paths are kind of roughly the same length, an approximation of what's happening here is that the strength of signal A1 at B2 is like this distance versus this distance, or, you know, and if we have other paths, like they just either add or subtract based on how, whether they constructively or destructively interfere. So we can kind of, as a simplified model, say, okay, B1 is going to have a signal which is 0.9 times the A1 signal and 0.7 times the A2 signal. B2 is going to have a signal which is the A1 signal plus 1.2 times the A2 signal. You know, for example, we'll have some numbers here. The numbers will vary depending on our exact situation. And this is a system of equations that we can solve if we just know this numbers. So how do we get the numbers? Well, we can have A send a test pattern where they just send A and then just A1 and just send A2. And then we can estimate those coefficients from that. We can maybe redo this periodically in case like the environment changes or like our laptop moves. But this gives us information to kind of actually get two signals over the same frequency, provided that we have enough difference between what we get at B1 and B2. So this is what sort of the modern versions of Wi-Fi use to have, at close range only, really high bit rates. Is that sort of the best supported scenario can send actually three different streams, assuming you have three receivers. And this works best over short distances where the difference in the signals are strong. It doesn't work so well over long distances because, well, the signal to noise ratio is very small and we actually need a lot to pick out. Signal, you'd think, not to blend together. Yeah, so we just solve for them. And for this to work well, we need to worry about how the streams are correlated. So this works best when our two signals are poorly correlated. And over a long distance, because our sort of main path is basically the same, closer to the same, they'll be much more correlated. And the issue with the signals being correlated is not that we can't solve the equation, but let's say our mixing is that we have this, at B1, we get A1 and A2 mixed together, and at B2, we get A1 and A2 mixed together, but A2 is a little strong. If we solve this equation, we find out that to decode A2, we're going to take the difference between B1 and B2 times 10. That times 10 means that in order to have information about the B1 signal, it needs to be basically 10 times stronger than it would be if we were just receiving one stream. So this is a reason why this does not work out very well over very long distances. This is mostly a technique that kind of improves the sort of amount of data we can send over short distances. Over long distances, you actually don't want to try to send multiple spatial streams. You probably want to fall back to these sorts of simpler ideas. And there's another problem with sending multiple spatial streams, which is a regulatory one, which is that the regulations often say the maximum power you're allowed to transmit. And when you have two transmitters like this, often that means the total power of both transmitters. So you so your actual power of each of these streams is lower. Not because of that regulatory constraint that you can't run the transmitter at the power you could run a single transmitter at without being, not in compliance with the FCC. Questions about our multiple spatial streams idea? Yeah. How do you get you have A send some test signals. So for example, A might just send A1 and you measure the power you receive at B1 and B2, then it just sends A2 and you measure the power, and that's a good approximation of the coefficients, and there's probably better ways, but it's all based on you send a known test signal. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I'll mention there's an assignment coming up, which is the last assignment I have planned. since. So this is a wireless assignment. It's maybe not. So in this assignment, we have one receiver and many senders, and we have no multipath. It's just the free space model of decay. And your job is to change the senders, how they do things. And the choices you have are that you can get channel sense, you can get the carrier sense idea, and we have a simplified carrier sense model without propagation delay. You can choose the channel you send on, or maybe with crap, but you can choose the channel you send on, and you can choose the timing of transmissions. And your goal is to get a certain number of transmissions to the destination in some amount of time, where they're spread randomly. We start you out with a default implementation of the senders that does some things that don't quite work. So notably, the other thing you can choose, the transmission power. So in the default scenario, they just retry 3 times. If it doesn't work, there's an ACK for each transmission that you're guaranteed to get. To simplify things, we don't have lost ACKs. In the default scenario, the transmission power chosen by default is sometimes too low because the senders are randomly spaced. And we have a receiver you aren't allowed to change that can receive from all the channels simultaneously. The idea is that this is simulating a kind of sensor network scenario where we have a bunch of environmental sensors, like temperature or something, spread out across an area, and we want to have them all sent to a common place. And that's due not next week, but after, I believe. Okay, so we talked about transmission. So talk about sort of management in Wi-Fi, and then talk a little about cellular networks, which work rather differently. So in Wi-Fi, there's kind of 2 modes of operation. And so far, we've been talking mostly kind of about things that look like this first mode, which is called so-called ad hoc, and it's actually a very rare mode for wireless networks to be in these days. This is where everyone can send to and from whoever, and there's no kind of actual central access point for a network. The way you make a network in the ad hoc space is you just decide, I'm choosing this channel, this network name, and you use it. And there's no one who's in charge of the network. You're just, using a channel and you have a name so you can identify what things belong on your network versus other people who happen to choose the same frequency. And then there's the infrastructure mode where we have these designated access points. And mostly that's what we use when we're cyber connecting to a network. We're probably connecting to an infrastructure Wi-Fi network. So networks are identified by what's called an SSID, which stands for Service Set Identifier, basically a network name. And the network name can have many access points. So EduRoam obviously isn't just one physical access point. There's a whole bunch of them. And clients are what's called associated with a particular access point. So that's what we do when we connect to a network. But your node on the network knows which access point it's talking to at any given time. It has communicated with that access point to indicate it's connected. And something that's maybe not intuitive is that clients only send through the access point. Even if we're talking to another machine who I'm sitting next to on an infrastructure network, we send to the access point. Not directly to that other machine. So, let's talk about that. So why do you think this helps or hurts? So we know, and so why do you think it helps? Because the Wi-Fi people chose to do this for some reason. Like, why does it help performance or, you know, or otherwise, I should say? Like, does it help logistically or with management or something? What are reasons why we'd want to send everything through the access point? Yeah.
I guess since you're sending through the access point to communicate with things outside, might as well keep the same structure so it's just less amount of work.
Okay, so your example, observation is the common case is 2AP, 2Outside. So we're just doing the common case all the time, and it's, you know, so simpler implementation. Okay. Any other ideas? Yeah.
I would just think, just intuitively, that it just kind of functions the same way as grabbing through a router, in that it logistically helps keep things in line. You can check and make sure everything gets sent properly.
So what do you mean by sent properly? So we can inspect sort of traffic centrally, is what you're getting at.
Yeah. Just like a central sort of
Okay. I guess as I hit here, there's a case where sending through the access point is gonna will help performance. Yeah. So you're arguing it does congestion control and routing. So it doesn't really do that, because that's being done by carrier sense on the signal for the most part. I guess especially if we aren't doing RTS-CTS. If we're doing RTS-CTS, then we kind of have that. I agree. But if we aren't, right, I think we send at the same time as we would, assuming everyone could hear each other otherwise. But there is something related to that, which is a big deal, where it's not like congestion control so much, but it's a sort of case where, let's say I have my access point here, and I have A over here and B over here. Yeah.
I guess it just helps with the hidden node problem.
Helps with not hidden nodes even, but if A wants to talk to B, they might be too far away, and this avoids that issue, right? We can talk to nodes, we can talk to any node in range of the access point. P, even if not in range of us. So that's a case where, you know, it really helps. And that, I think, also from a sort of management point of view, that's a lot more intuitive, right? So if we didn't do this, then you and I being connected to the same Wi-Fi network wouldn't mean that we could send to each other. And that would be pretty non-intuitive for many users. But since we go through the access point, that sort of connection model is simpler. That if it's connected to the Wi-Fi network, these two devices can talk to each other. And we could imagine maybe a way of having them talk directly when they can and not directly when they can't, but that seems logistically difficult, especially since it might change whether they can reach each other directly over time. But I think that's the primary reason that this is done, is that it avoids the issue of having two nodes connected to Wi-Fi that can't talk to each other. As for hurting performance, let's consider, you know, what the case here is where we go A to B. The problem is that we're using one channel, so we're going to have A sends to the access point, A sends to B, so we're not going to, you know, if we could talk to each other, it would be better, because we're going to be sending twice as much stuff over the single channel. You know, that's going to limit how much we can use the channel usefully. So we have these access points, and mentioning we don't associate with them, our clients have to discover these access points to associate with them. And there's kind of two ways that works. So one way that works is that access points will send out, usually about every 100 milliseconds, a beacon. And this beacon will give the MAC address of the access point. And an SSID, and also all the kind of information about how the network is configured. And this is kind of the passive way that if you have a list of wireless networks you can join, this is how that's populated. It's by listening for these, and they're typically, as I said, sent every like 10 times a second, so you don't have to listen for very long to do that. And since these are sent on different channels, usually you'll have to scan every channel for these beacons. There's also an option to send probes, and there are probe responses which basically look the same, except they're solicited over a Wi-Fi channel. So you say, hey, I'd like to know about all the access points, and you get all the responses back. So once we get these beacon messages, the client will then send an association request. And the access point will say, yes, you successfully associated. This is also when things related to Wi-Fi security, passwords, encryption setup are done. And sometimes the client will deassociate from the network. Sometimes it will just stop transmitting, and the access point will have to realize, well, it must not be there anymore. Now, often a big Wi-Fi network, as I mentioned, will have multiple access points. So something clients are supposed to do is that they're supposed to look at these beacons, and in addition to looking at, well, what networks are available, this tells them which access points are available for the network I'm already connected to. So the networks identified by this SSID can say what other networks' access points seem like a candidate for that. And it can use this information to switch to a better access point as your phone or laptop moves around, at least in theory. Or you can just wait until the other access point stops working and reassociate them. But these beacons kind of give you the information to not only know what networks are available, but to measure their quality, because you can record how good was the signal to noise ratio when I received this beacon. And that kind of tells you how good is my connection to this access point likely to be. Questions about associations. So then, once we're associated, we send data frames. And somewhat confusingly, our data frames contain a whole bunch of data, and they also we have, this is the information on which sort of network we're connected to, which network is this data frame for, and we have two source and two destination addresses, which seems kind of confusing. And And you notice we also have, at the beginning of our data frame, we say how long it is so people can plan their transmissions. And then we have the actual data. In this case, we also have stuff related to encryption. And I believe this sequence numbers helps us make sure the ACK matches up with this frame. So why do we have three different addresses here? And that's because we can have things take multiple hops over Wi-Fi. So one case where this happens was the case we talked about earlier, where we go from A to access point to B. So we have the receiver and transmitter, which is separate from the destination and source, because I'm going to send from, if I'm doing the transmission from A to access point to B, then my transmitter is A and my receiver is the access point, but my destination is B. And you might say, well, wouldn't we just use the IP address? Well, no, because Wi-Fi is trying to look like something like an Ethernet network. And remember, like an Ethernet network, we had a switch. We used MAC addresses all the time to identify what node to talk to. So on the Wi-Fi network, we're supposed to be able to just use the MAC address to talk to another node. We don't have to use IP. Right? This PAT data doesn't even have to be an IP packet. Good question?
Yeah, so I thought in that case, the transmitter address should be the A, B, IP address, and receiver and destination should be B.
So in this case, the receiver and destination should be B?
And the transmitter should be AP instead of A, right?
Should be AP. In the case from A to B, I'm talking A to the AP. Yes, that's what I say. So this would be, I annotated this incorrectly. So I think in this case, I think the receiver should be the AP, the transmitter should be A, the source should be A, the destination should be B.
Well, it's just based on this receiver and destination address, like they're the same. So I'm assuming that this is from AP to B.
Yeah, this example is something different, yes. This example is from the AP to B. Yes, sorry. Yeah, that's what you're getting at, is that the actual packet trace I have here represents this sort of scenario. You are correct. Sorry, I was just talking more generally about how the signals are used, but yes, in this specific example, this we can tell is being sent from the access point. Another way we can tell that is that the network is identified by the access point's MAC address. Yeah, so this example is a packet from AP to B. If we had it from, we'd have different sort of mixes of source and destination. And something that Wi-Fi supports doing is that we can actually, since we can have one network with multiple APs, and the APs could be connected by Wi-Fi to each other, we can actually have a case where we go from A to B through two different APs. And potentially, if we have a packet being sent between AP1 and AP2 over wireless, that would be a case where all four of those fields would be different, where the source and destination would be A and B, but the receiver and transmitter would be AP1 and AP2. AP2 and AP1. Yeah, so we have these extra addresses, and yeah, the thing you should think about is that, like, we usually think about Wi-Fi just handling IP, where, you know, these extra addresses don't make sense, but it's really supposed to be a link layer protocol like in Ethernet switches. And you mentioned having multiple access points that are kind of part of one network. And so when we have multiple access points for one network, they'll be connected via what we'll call a distribution system. And since this is one network, we need to be able to have stuff coming from the outside that says, like, goes to F, and this distribution system needs to know, well, that means I go to AP3. And similarly, if F, like, wants to send something to B, this distribution system needs to figure out what 8 access points to send that through. So we're going to have this kind of back end for a Wi-Fi network. And basically, our distribution system needs to have something like a neighbor table for all the access points that is shared around so they can know how to send route traffic internally. And, well, this isn't routing in the that we've seen before, because we're not doing IP routing, we're doing MAC address routing. And maybe if we're getting something in from the outside, we're doing MAC address routing combined with IP routing, right? We're going to look up the IP address to MAC translation, then we're going to have some sort of mapping saying which MAC addresses are connected to which APs. And so this is what we have when sort of a big wireless network's access one. And probably the ideal situation is that if we have fixed access points, we just have them connected via a very fast wired network. But this distribution system can be, and actually surprisingly often is, wireless. That there will be wireless links between the APs to do that. And the reason you do that is, well, if you're selling network hardware, it's a lot easier to tell people you just need to have these access points close enough to each other and they'll work than it is to tell people you need to connect all your access points to a special router and then configure special switches and then configure those switches so they're connected to each other in the correct way. It's easier to make kind of a turnkey solution that way, and also like works better for deploying wireless to places that maybe don't have a great wire network. So that's kind of our brief on access points. Where did I put that? Okay. So there's something we're going to do different in the cellular space. So we talked about access points. Kind of each access point chooses. Each like node on a Wi-Fi chooses what access point to associate with. And we wanted to track things centrally. Cellular networks work in a more complicated way. And part of the reason for this is that we have a much wider network. Another part of the reason is that we have often multiple parties involved. It's because we have cellular roaming, so you can be connected to a cellular network that is run by a different company even. We need to make that work. And even if it's run by the same company, they probably split up their operations so they don't have like one server for the entire country. You know, they have different servers for different regions to handle coordinating devices. And if you look at our textbook, they have this wonderful, confusing picture because the cellular people like making up their own terms for everything and then using acronyms for those terms. And also, like, building on the terms over 5 just versions of the standard. But basically what we have here is that our cellular devices are connected to base stations that have overlapping service areas. And something that will happen in the cellular space is that rather than each cellular device deciding which base station to talk to and deciding how to, like, when to move to other base stations, is the base stations will figure out, you know, when they want to hand over a connection from one base station to another, so that they're doing some central planning here. And generally, there's going to be a lot more central planning in this cellular space. And when we're connected to a base station, we're going to have our connection goes through goes from the base station and gets sent to a service gateway, and then from a service gateway to a PDN packet distribution network gateway. And the idea here is that the base station is kind of dumb. The base station doesn't actually know how to deal with routing things between cellular phones. All it knows how to do is how to forward the traffic from each device to the appropriate service gateway. And this thing called a mobility management engine is going to set up these links from the base station to one or more service gateways, and it's going to configure them separately for each cellular device that is on the base station. This is also where it handles things like making sure you actually have a phone plan when doing that. So the base station doesn't actually know how to route your traffic. It just knows that there's this tunnel, there's this connection for this cell phone goes to this gateway. The gateway handles, where do I actually do that? And typically there's this extra step where it goes to the actual output to the network, to the internet. And you might say, why do we have these in different locations? And a big reason for that is that this can't really move because the internet has to get to it, right? So if we have it move all around all the time, then we have to change how the rest of the internet routes to it. So this will generally be in a fixed location for the, you know, over time, even if we move around, because our, you know, if we have a connection open viewing something on our phone, it needs to go to the same place, the same IP address. That route's not, we can't just change that route all the time. And so that's going to go to that PDN gateway that's fixed, even if we move around, and it might be better to have a local service gateway be closer to where we actually are. And so there's this mobility management system, and this HSS stands for Home Subscriber Server, so that's what the cellular standards call the sort of database of what customers do we have and all that information that's stored there. So the mobility management engine sends up these tunnels, as they're called, between for the base station to send your traffic. But the base station and the cellular device are like actually kind of dumber as far as how they move packets around than our Wi-Fi space. As we'll see, they're a lot smarter in how we use the radio bandwidth. That's going to be much smarter than it is in Wi-Fi. And yeah, this is the iteration there. So our cell phone goes to a base station, goes to a service gateway, goes to a PDN gateway. And the design architecture here is that these tunnels are all set up by one entity rather than having our base station actually know how to connect your cell phone to the internet. It doesn't keep track of that information. And the base station also therefore doesn't know like how to talk to how when your cell phone's talking to another cell phone. The base station can't handle that. It doesn't even know the information about that. It's just blindly forwarding everything to the gateway. The other thing about this architecture is that this works a lot better for roaming because we end up sending to, you know, a PDN gateway that is in your sort of home cellular network. So you always have a consistent cellular connection that always comes from, you know, if you're a Verizon subscriber, through Verizon servers, even if it's roaming. So that's sort of how association works in space. So I mentioned the idea of sort of sending things between access points, and talked about this kind of ad hoc idea where anyone could send to whoever. And an idea which has come up a lot in the Wi-Fi space is rather than having this sort of central coordination of access points and cell towers, we could have what's commonly known as a mesh network. And an early example of this is RoofNet from 2005. This is a map of Cambridge with dots on it where there were access points. And we mentioned that Wi-Fi has kind of a useful range of a few kilometers. So these access points formed one network that sometimes needs multiple hops between access points. And what we talked about so far, like, we haven't talked about how do you coordinate that sort of network. And RoofNet did something where they built something on top of Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi didn't support the things they wanted natively, and I think that's still kind of true, even though there are commercial products that set up mesh networks like this too. So what did they do to handle this? Well, they did link state routing. So they had the nodes do a link state routing protocol. And when they sent packets, they did something that's commonly known as source routing, where the packet included, so if we have A to B, the packet actually says, you know, A to X to Y to B, is that this is in the packet here. And as it's forwarded, we kind of remove entries. So this goes to X, and when X sends out the packet, it's going to send Y to B. And there'll be a sort of an alternate source, A via Y to B sort of thing. So our packets will basically say, you know, A to B via a list, and we'll edit that list as the packet gets forwarded, but basically the packets specify the full path they're supposed to take. And they chose that rather than doing what we saw in link state routing before, where we just send, you know, we have every node knows where we're supposed to go next. The reason they didn't do that is because they were worried about frequent changes in link quality and metrics, meaning that those would be inconsistent and that we'd have these transient routing loops if we didn't do that, or transient unreachability. So we use link state, and we just have you compute the full path and put it in the packet. And we look, and when we're forwarding, we look at the next, we look to see where we are in that path and send to that place. And in this thing design, they also had everyone was using the same channel. So this was a kind of successful example. Now, the bit rates they got were not amazing, but it was free internet access in 2005 across the city. And the other kind of change for sort of our routing protocol here is that to make this work, we don't like have, with wired networks, like we kind of have a very good idea, is the wire connected or not? With wireless, we kind of have to send out probes periodically and look for responses to like figure out what's our actual connectivity, and it's going to change over time, kind of with things like weather and so on. And also with wireless, routing metrics are going to be a lot different. So with kind of our traditional like wired routing, we were mostly saying, what's the bandwidth? Or how many hops is it? With this, we probably really want to take into account signal quality, because we know we can have some really bad connections from a reliability point of view, and we want to avoid using that. And so as I mentioned, this is sort of commercialized versions of this infrastructure that are typically run by one entity are a very common solution for I'm setting up a wireless network in my buildings. Is that a vendor will sell you something where the nodes coordinate using something like this link state routing protocol with each other and run a distribution center for a distribution system for the access points using a self-configured wireless mesh network like this. So basically, you plug some APs into an internet connection, they realize they have an internet connection, you have some APs that don't, they all do something like state routing to figure out how to route packets between each other, and they share the data, the neighbor tables for implementing the distribution. So they're saying this MAC address is associated with which access point. And this is kind of what you see in the space of sort of commercial large Wi-Fi installations. Most of these are unfortunately proprietary, which the vendors really like because it makes it really hard to switch vendors. Because if you have, you can't have half your access points from one company, half from another. There's apparently been a movement to have a Wi-Fi standard. I don't know if anyone's really implemented it. Question? Or any questions on? Okay, so far we've talked about kind of networks where it's kind of where there's some centralization, but for the most part, the way things are transmitted is someone decides to transmit, they see if the channel looks free, and they transmit. There's another design which is more efficient and what cellular networks notably use, which is more centrally planned. And I'll start by giving this simple example of a simple version of this, which is Wi-Fi's polling mode. So Wi-Fi's polling mode is almost never used, but I'm going to talk about it because it's going to help us explain what cellular networks are doing. So in Wi-Fi's polling mode, rather than the access point just accepting packets at any time, the access point explicitly tells nodes when they're allowed to transmit. So it sends out a packet saying, for the next millisecond, I'm transmitting, no one else talks. And then it sends out a packet saying, you know, hey, node A, do you have anything to send? And node A has to respond then, and that's node A's slot to learn. And maybe there's, and then there's like some periodic point to ask, say, are there any new nodes? You know, you're supposed to wait until the right time. So the idea is that our access point is telling everyone when they're allowed to transmit, coordinating the timing of transmissions, including saying, you know, if you want to transmit, we're going to give you an opportunity like every millisecond. And you have to transmit then. You aren't allowed to choose your time. So what's the advantage here? Advantage or disadvantage of this? Yeah.
Well, I guess this would be the main point, that it's very streamlined and everything's very in order to the point where things don't clash or collide with each other.
Yeah, so this avoids collisions very aggressively. Yeah, so especially if we don't have new nodes joining which need to like transmit at a random time, we have literally no collisions. We've solved the collision problem. Disadvantage? Yeah. Yeah, so if we're just, if the polling takes time, even if there's nothing to transmit. So, you know, if we have a lot of nodes that mostly aren't transmitting, we're going to spend a lot of time polling all of them. And we have to give them a separate time slot for each polling so they don't clash when they do have something to send. Or if we don't, like, we have to handle that somehow. Another disadvantage is that this is going to increase the latency of transmitting for nodes that aren't the access point. Because, you know, whereas previously they would transmit in the next available slot, they have to wait for their turn, and that's probably going to be a longer time. So I guess we'll talk next time, but cellular networks do basically an accelerate a big version of this kind of this idea, where they will tell the cellular devices, here's when you transmit. And not only here's when you transmit, here's what channel you transmit on. And they kind of plan that centrally, and the idea is that this gets us much better utilization of the channel, that we don't have collisions in that scheme. Because if almost all of your transmissions are planned, then planned, then they shouldn't collide at all. And so that's what cellular networks use. That's what we'll talk briefly about next time, and then we'll move on to talking about firewalls. So that's where I'll finish up today.